keeping hope alive in dark times.
He says that hope is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizon.
That's Martin Keogh, quoting from Vaclav Havel, one of many voices he shares with us in the book he edited, Hope Beneath Our Feet. We'll spend the hour with Keogh and some of those who contributed essays to his anthology, Bill McKibben, Francis Moore LaPaix, and Paul Hawken. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 27,000 species go extinct every year now. That means two had gone extinct during my interview with Martin Keogh. Our own species is facing possible major die-offs, and time is running out. If our world is facing imminent environmental catastrophe, how do I live my life right now? That's a question Martin Keogh posed to a range of writers, thinkers, and activists, people like Diane Ackerman, Paul Hawken, Barbara Kingsolver, Francis Moore LaPaix, Bill McKibben, Michael Pollan, and Alice Walker. The terrific anthology of essays that came out of that question and that Martin Keogh edited is called Hope Beneath Our Feet, Restoring Our Place in the Natural World. Keogh is not an author, nor, before this, even an editor. He teaches and performs contact improvisation and has also been a teacher of Zen. But Hope Beneath Our Feet provides much-needed inspiration, personal, spiritual, and political. Inspiration as we gather with how to live as loving and hopeful human beings in a world that's in grave danger. Martin Keogh, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Hope Beneath Our Feet, Restoring Our Place in the Natural World, I think is one of the best collections of writing like this, and I do a lot of reading in this kind of writing that I've seen. It's a beautiful book. I want to ask you, what inspired you to do this?
Well, Francesca, first, thanks for having me. The story about how the book came about, I think the news is out there every day for people to hear and see about what's going wrong with the environment at every level. And I believe that it's easier to hold it out than to let it in. And often there's one detail that gets through to people. And for me, it happened right after my son was born. And it's funny because I'll never forget the night. We live in New England, and we were in our apartment, and it was snowing outside. And my three stepsons were sleeping in the other room. And my wife was holding our newborn son in her arms. And I was sitting in a chair on the computer, on the internet, and I was reading about how fast the coral reefs are dying. And suddenly I realized, this is the world that my son is coming into. This is our world, and this is happening very fast. And I realized at that point that I have to do something, and as a result, this book appeared.
So you got some of the real leading thinkers on environmentalism, on what's happening to our planet and how to deal with it. You've got a roster here. Paul Hawken, Bill McKibben, Michael Pollan, Francis Moore LaPaix, and on and on. Let's start with Paul Hawken. Your first essay in the book is Paul Hawken's. I've spoken to Paul Hawken before. Actually, I've interviewed him about his book, Blessed Unrest, and he's, he's a businessman. He was, sold garden implements, Hawken catalog, wonderful garden tools, and been doing a lot of thinking about business and the environment. He gave a commencement address, and he really posed the question that is front and center for, I know at least for myself and probably for many of us, if our world is really looking down the barrel of an environmental catastrophe, how do I live my life right now?
Well, that was the question that was asked of all the authors. That's what they responded to write their essays for this book. And one thing I love about Paul Hawken's piece, everybody came referred to me, and Paul Hawken was one person. He kindly turned me down 5 times. And finally, on the 6th time, he said yes. And he gave me the commencement address that he gave at the University of Portland in 2009. And it became the first piece of the book. And I love this piece. And as people have been reading it, they've been sending me in their favorite quotes from the book. I call them the proverbs in the book. And there's one that several people have sent me from his piece that I'd love to read. Again, this is him talking to these graduating students from the university. And he says, "There's invisible writing on the back of the diploma you will receive. And in case you didn't bring lemon juice to decode it, I can tell you what it says. You are brilliant, and the earth is hiring. The earth couldn't afford to send recruiters or limos to your school. It sent you rain, sunsets, ripe cherries, night-blooming jasmine, and that unbelievably cute person you're dating. Take the hint. And here's the deal. Forget that this task of planet saving is not possible in the time required. Don't be put off by people who know what is not possible. Do what needs to be done and check to see if it was impossible only after you are done."
Yeah, that's really, really wonderful. I have one, too, that I loved. He said, "Working for the earth is not a way to get rich. It's a way to be rich."
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was just beautiful. And he also mentions my favorite poet, Mary Oliver, who has such an amazing sense of a place in the natural environment. Now, the other one I thought was really interesting was Vicki Robbins' Letter from the Future. Tell us who Vicki Robbins is and who's she writing to?
Vicki Robbins wrote the book with Juan Domingo called Your Money or Your Life. And the two of them used to be involved in high finance in New York City, and they realized that in their pursuit for money, they were basically killing their lives. And they've written this book, I don't know how many millions of copies it has sold, which is about how to be rich and to really know what is enough. So her pedigree, her history is wonderful in terms of what she's put into the world, especially about this thing of enoughness, because clearly our desire for more and more is one of the things that's really putting a stress on our planet. But she writes a piece from herself 20 years in the future, after we've gone through this very hard transition to a better time. And in the piece to herself, she says, "Well, I can't tell you exactly what to do, but I can hint, hint, nudge, nudge, tell you the things you're doing right now." And she goes through a whole list of things of kind of what she's doing right about flying less and knowing everybody around her within 50 miles so that the community becomes stronger, so that the things you need you're not getting from so far away. And it's just a wonderful piece with really good humor in it.
And she also, you know, gives one the sense, which, you know, I have to say I wholeheartedly hope she's right, you know, that we pull through this.
Yeah, it's interesting. This book, it's not a litany. It's not a catalog of what's wrong. I mean, it doesn't shy away from that. But what I really didn't want is for people to read it and to get all the facts and just want to crawl under their bed and not do anything. So much like Paul Hawken's book, Blessed Unrest, and Bill McKibben's book, Hope, Human, and Wild, it's about the things that are going right. And it's interesting, when I first asked people, how do you answer this question? We really are in this environmental crisis. How do we live our lives right now? The first thing that I realized is that there's a flutter that people do with their hands when they've been asked a question that's too big for them to imagine. And often I would see this flutter, and then people would say, "Oh, God, how can you think about things like that with just, you know, the everyday stresses of life?" Or they would change the subject and talk about smaller problems like, "Oh, you know, my husband's leaving me," or "the IRS is coming after me," something they could actually imagine. And it was because of that little flutter that I realized I need to ask people who've been really thinking about this. So I started to ask my friends, "Who do you know who's been thinking about this?" And then I could use that their name as a referral to say, "Hey, so-and-so said to be in touch." And it's interesting, the first essays to come in were really doomsday essays. They were the ones that said, oh, hug your loved ones while you can. Things are getting really bad. You might as well stock food in caves in the Sierras. And those essays did not help me at all want to be active in the world. They, like I said, just wanted me to crawl under the bed and do nothing. And then essays began to come in. And I would say I got 9 essays with this Gandhi quote. And it's funny, I love this quote where he says, you must be the change you want to see in the world. And as much as I love that quote, what I realized was all the people who used that quote in their essays weren't doing anything in the world. And as much as I like to get up in the morning and do my yoga and do my meditation, and I don't like this phrase, I began to call these essays the navel-gazing pieces. Then the next round of essays were from people who were doing something. They had started a sustainability group, a localization group, a local town group. They were working with, you know, getting the schools to put up no idling signs. And it became really clear to me that this book was going to become 100 different doorways that people could get engaged. So the antidote to despair would be participation and engagement.
Yeah, you know, Michael Pollan puts it in your book. He says, you know, there's so many stories we can tell ourselves to justify doing nothing. And in fact, you do hear that a lot. You say, you know, people say, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's already upon us. But he says the most insidious is that whatever we do manage to do, it'll be too little, too late. And, you know, and I have to say, I struggle between these two views. Mm-hmm. Yes, I know that if I do nothing, then I can't really live with myself, mm-hmm. you know. But it seems as if doing something is therapy. It's not really going to change things.
Yeah, and Michael Pollan also points out that a lot of people think that somebody else is going to take care of it, or that science is going to do it, or the politicians are going to do it. And his essay is called Why Bother? And there's a quote in there about exactly this thing. He says, for us to wait for legislation or technology to solve the problem of how we're living our lives suggests that we're not really serious about changing, something our politicians cannot fail to notice. They will not move until we do. Indeed, to look to leaders and experts, to laws and money and grand schemes to save us from our predicament represents precisely the sort of thinking, passive, delegated, dependent on specialists for solutions that helped get us into this mess in the first place.
That's Martin Keogh quoting from Michael Pollan's essay in the anthology Hope Beneath Our Feet, which Keogh edited. We just went through an election where a number, basically the House of Representatives is now dominated by people who either don't care to address the issue of climate change or are actively fighting any efforts to address it. So what you're saying here, I think, and they were swept into power by, you know, at least an ostensibly grassroots movement, although I think it's more probably in many ways a grassroots movement that was really funded by billionaires.
Right.
But it just underscores that if you have a loud voice and you make yourself heard, you can make some changes.
And yes, more of us need to make ourselves heard on this side of things. It's interesting to me, but Barbara Kingsolver's piece, she talks about, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years back, there was a sighting down in Georgia of the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Oh, yes.
And this bird hadn't been seen in decades. And it really caught people's imagination that this bird had been seen again. And she posits in her piece that it's, well, maybe if that bird come back, then maybe we can all come back. And, you know, despite this huge wave of politicians going in, each of us doing something is so important. And one of the pieces that quotes from the book that has been sent to me many times is from Barbara's piece. And she says, it's the worst of bad manners and self-protection, I think, in a nervously cynical society to ridicule the small gesture. Those earnest efforts might just get us past the train wreck of the daily news, or the anguish of standing behind a child, looking with her at the road ahead, searching out redemption where we can find it, recycling or carpooling or growing a garden or saving a species or something. Small, stepwise changes in personal habits aren't trivial. Ultimately, they will or won't add up to having been the thing that mattered.
Yeah, but it's more than small steps. I mean, you also talked to some people who are building big movements out of small steps. One of them is Bill McKibben.
Yeah, there's one chapter in the book called Small Steps and another chapter called Big Steps. And in the Big Steps chapter, there's one woman, Thais Mazur, who took on this
terrific.
The giant, the biggest corporation in the world. It's privately owned. It's Koch Industries.
In fact, the very people who funded
exactly
the Tea Party movement.
Right.
Yes.
To help them not have regulations. They would shut down their businesses.
Right.
But in Mendocino County, Thais found out that they were about to sell this giant mill in Fort Bragg to open it up for construction. And she was hearing all of these little hints from people who used to work there that the place was incredibly contaminated. And she and two friends started going to the city council meetings. They started doing research. They started writing editorials saying, hey, this has to be cleaned up first. And Koch Industries did all kinds of things, including getting the police to tail them everywhere and to harass them. And as a result, they started a police watch up there and got those police fired. And just the work they did over years. And now what they got was the state EPA to oversee the cleanup, which isn't so much in the corporation's pocket as the organization that used to watch them. And so talking about a big step, I mean, this was years of her life spent in this kind of research and basically saying, wait a minute. And she had a daughter who was a few years old, and she was just saying, we can't live in a country that does this to our children. And she went to battle for everybody.
Yeah, and another woman who did that, who started very small and who has now, I think, been responsible for the planting of over a million trees in Africa, a woman I've had the privilege to meet and speak with, Wangari Maathai,
mm-hmm.
Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai. What a force for good in this world. What a powerful person. Tell us about her and her essay.
Well, again, this is where something small can grow into something very big. And Vandana Shiva as well in India has the same thing of empowering women. The two of them basically said, well, for us to create social justice and sustainability, we need to empower women. And so they did it through planting trees, which, as it turned out, really helped the climate, helped bring more business in, and helped green the country. And then she was the first person to win the Nobel Peace Prize for planting trees.
Yeah.
Vandana Shiva, she has a piece. She was the first person to win the Right Livelihood Award, which they call the Alternative Peace Prize. And the little quote from her piece, which is called Earth Rights, she says, ahimsa, or nonviolence, is the basis of many faiths that have emerged on Indian soil. Translated into economics, nonviolence implies that our systems of production, trade, and consumption should not use up the ecological space of other species and other people. Whenever we engage in consumption or production patterns that take more than we need, we are engaging in violence. Non-sustainable consumption and non-sustainable production constitute a violent economic order.
Another one of your authors, Michael Nagler, N-A-G-L-E-R, talks about how this is fundamentally a spiritual crisis that we face, and that what we need to do is create a new spiritual sense. Talk more about that.
It's interesting because what I realized when I was engaging with this question before I started asking other people, I would lay in bed at night, and my heart would beat in my chest in the middle of the night, just as I was really concerned about our world, about how fast the forests are going and the species loss and the oceans, you know, not to mention climate change, the giant elephant in the room. And I realized that I needed more than just practical things of what I could do. And so the book is also filled with kind of spiritual advice. And so there's several spiritual leaders in here, Byron Katie and Andrew Cohen, and then Michael Nagler also just speaks about how we really need a change in perspective before we're going to change the world, that just going out and being active isn't going to do the trick, because we really need, in a sense, a global change of perspective to make things better.
And how does that happen?
Well, my feeling is that there's a way in which everybody has to take one step. In a sense, everybody has to become an environmentalist. And that's, I think, the goal of this book, again, is to give 100 different doorways so people reading through it will find one or two voices that speak right to them. And maybe it's on a spiritual level where they see the world differently, or they see their interconnectedness with nature more clearly. Or, you know, maybe they're right now recycling and composting, but they take the next step to call their representative. If they're calling their representative, maybe they're going to call some corporate leaders. If they're already calling corporate leaders, maybe they're going to go down and insist to talk to them. If they're already insisting to talk to them, maybe they're going to choose one species that they're going to put all their attention on saving. If they're already doing that, maybe they're going to go and chain themselves to a tree. But if everybody can just take one step from where they are right now, then we have kind of a global change. And I don't see, you know, people who going from not recycling to suddenly being out there with their banners protesting something. But if we can just get everybody to lean a little bit. And the image I use in the introduction is that the trajectory we're on right now as a civilization is really right toward over a cliff. It's to a non-human future on this planet. But if we can all lean, then we can change that trajectory.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Martin Keogh. He's the editor of a new anthology, Hope Beneath Our Feet, Restoring Our Place in the Natural World. Toward the end of your book, you have a little chapter here, The Grandmothers Speak. This spoke directly to me. When I became a grandmother, I mean, I was interested in climate change before then, but when I became a grandmother, that was my moment of truth. For you, it was when you became a father. And I can feel the tears rising from my throat right now as I speak. Talk about Janine Prevot and Anne Rosencrantz. What are they saying about the grandmother speaking?
Well, I mean, this thing you said about tears, I think, is so important because Janine Giotti, is what she goes by, had this image that she had to draw together 13 indigenous grandmothers, leaders of different tribes around the world. And she followed this image that she had, and she found these 13 women from every continent except Antarctica. And it turned out that many of them had had the same dream, like as a child, that they would be together with this group of women. And they now travel around the world, again, speaking about social justice, speaking about sustainability. But she quotes one of the grandmothers in her essay, saying, "The most important journey we can take is the 18 inches from our eyes down to our hearts." And this place from our heart of relating to this world that we're in and feeling the loss that's going on right now is so important. Nina Simons, in her piece, talks about how we really can't act for the world until we begin to grieve the losses that are happening right now. When they speak of this extinction event that's going on, You know, it's been going on for a long time. It actually began when people started doing agriculture. So it's not brand new, but in the last few decades, it has really picked up. And again, the book is not filled with details like this, but I think it's important to know the context in which we are grieving and acting. And they say that in normal times, between 10 and 100 species would go extinct in a year. And now, because of how much this has accelerated over the last 10,000 years, but especially in the last two decades, about two species will go extinct by the time this interview is over.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so we're talking about, you know, they can't give the numbers exactly, but at the low end, like 500 a year. Excuse me, 27,000 in a year at the low end.
27,000?
Yeah, species that are extinct.
In fact, they're saying, I heard it the other day, that this, we are now, species are going extinct at the rate that they did 65 million years ago when there was the Great Extinction. What, 90% of the species on the planet went extinct, or maybe it was 99. I don't know, but it was
a
lot.
And yes, and it's funny, half of the primates are on the verge or on the way to extinction. And we are a primate. And at some point, I really don't think that people are suicidal. I really believe that we do act in our best self-interest, which at first can be selfish. But I think when people become clear at what's going on, I think they will act. And it's interesting, my book just came out, and over the summer, all of the whole first print run ran out before the book was even released. And I think the reason for that was because we had the big oil spill in the Gulf, but also people were seeing that the temperature in Pakistan went up to 124 degrees. And then, of course, a week later, they had that storm that put a fifth of the country underwater and 2 million people who are still homeless. And I think people began to, like, as I said, one detail breaks a person open. And I think a lot of people got broken open and are now starting to look, oh, what can I do? How can I hold these facts that are going on?
Yeah, you know, it's that delicate balance between not getting into denial. You know, there are many people I've heard say, well, you know, you can't talk about what's happening because you'll just turn people off.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, you know, I've heard a note of that in your book as well, but it's not a book of denial. Hope beneath our feet, restoring our place in the natural world. I mean, that's a positive statement, but as you say, it's within a context. How do you dance that line between not denying what's going on, confronting it full on, and maintaining your hope? Now, after you've spoken to all these wonderful people that are in your book, after 4 years of work, where have you come to?
Well, I'm going to answer that with a quote by Vaclav Havel. This quote almost was the front page of the book. It ended up not getting in, but it's about this whole thing of hope. He says that hope is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizon. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously heading for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more propitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper the hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. So I'm not feeling optimistic about the world. As Bill McKibben says, all the trend lines are going in the wrong direction. But also, as Bill McKibben says, we don't have to fix everything. We just have to get the trend lines going the right way. And I'm in this belief of so many people in the book that we have to do something. And Frances Moore LePage, she's the woman who wrote...
Diet for a Small Planet.
This was before the phrase carbon footprint existed. And it's so interesting because the one thing that a person can do now to lower their carbon footprint the most, far more than going from your Escalade to a Prius, is to stop eating meat. That they say, lowers your carbon footprint by 25%. This is difficult for me. I'm a dancer. I love meat. It gives me a lot of energy. But I have somehow been able to cut down my meat consumption by 90% because of that. But there's something that she says in her essay, which is called Every Day We Choose. And this is one of the things that really keeps me going. She says, ultimately, if we accept ecology's insights that we exist in densely woven networks, then we must also accept that every choice we make sends out ripples, even if we're not consciously choosing. The choice we have is not whether, but only how we change the world.
That's so wonderful. And she is she's a personal hero of mine. I remember reading Diet for a Small Planet in the early 70s. It changed my life. And she's been doing some terrific work on democracy.
Democracy and participatory democracy.
Yeah. Well, your book, Hope Beneath Our Feet, Martin Keogh, the book you edited, it is a terrific collection of essays, of thoughts, of wisdom that is sorely needed in these difficult times. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca, for having me. And I would just invite your listeners to find something they can do, one way to get engaged, one way to participate. It is a great antidote to despair.
Martin Keogh. He's donating 25% of the book's profits to environmental causes. You can find quotes from Hope Beneath Our Feet by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we hear from some of the contributors to Keogh's anthology. Stay tuned.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on.
Back to Writer's Voice, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first segment of today's show, we heard from Martin Keogh about his anthology of essays, Hope Beneath Our Feet. It's about how to live our lives in the face of environmental catastrophe. In our second segment, we'll hear excerpts from Writer's Voice interviews with some of the contributors to the book. First up, Paul Hawken. I spoke with Hawken in 2007. His book, Blessed Unrest, is about the worldwide movement for social and environmental change. It includes everything from singleperson.coms to billion-dollar nonprofits, organizing from the grassroots in every city, town, and culture. Altogether, Paul Hawken says, these groups comprise the largest movement on Earth and in history. And, he says, it's a kind of immune system for the planet.
The interesting thing about immune systems are that we don't understand them that well, first of all. Second, they're the most complex system in the body, more complicated than the brain, more differentiated, different types of cells than any other organ. And, of course, it's not an organ, it's a system. But what's interesting is that the immune system functions better, that is, it's more resilient, when it is better networked. That is, the better networked the system, and it is a network, the more immune the organism is to invasive organisms, disease. So that was what that was a real insight for me, because I realized that this movement is networked and getting better at it. It's not as nearly networked as it could be, I believe. But because of modern communication technology, cell phone, internet, email, etc., that you're seeing a real shift in this movement from being, in a sense, atomistic, that is to say, organizations scattered and distributed in different places all around the world, in different areas, not aware of each other, and you're starting to see, you can't really see it actually, but imagine and experience this movement really getting hooked up. And as it gets hooked up, it gets much more powerful and effective than when it works by itself. But the immune system is, as I said, really just an astonishing aspect of an organism, and ours, the human beings, is the most complex of almost any organism.
Could you give us an example of how a group or how this system, this movement functions in the immune system?
Well, when you see, Seattle, which is, even though it was 8 years ago, I mean, WTO protests in November 1999, November 30 starting December, Seattle is a case in point, which is where civil society around the world belled the cat of economic fundamentalism. I mean, that's really what happened in Seattle. But those protests, basically, who organized them? Who led them? Some people stand up and say they did, but they didn't. And the way it was organized, in both on the street and prior to the protest, was a perfect example of this sort of immune response. And after that, the WTO and constituent types of trade organizations were never able to meet again without those who were and are excluded from the deliberative processes being out there and making noise and insisting that they participate, insisting that the stakeholders of the world have a say in trade policy. And to this day, the Doha Round, literally the things that were in the 1999 proposals in Seattle have still not been adopted by the world, and that would not be true were it not for Seattle. So, but then the February 13th, 2003 protests against the invasion of Iraq by the coalition of the so-called willing, led by the United States, where 10 to 12 million people marched in the world. I mean, that's humanity's immune response. Against here, I could say, well, yeah, but, you know, the war went on. Mm-hmm, it did. But every time this happens now, it gets more and more powerful, and the connections that are made in these kinds of protests and demonstrations are not connections that are easily lost.
Paul Hawken talking about his book, Blessed Unrest. Frances Moore-LaPaix is best known for her book, Diet for a Small Planet, first published in 1975. It changed the way a lot of people, including me, thought about food and how food fits into the ecology of the planet. LaPaix's book, Democracy's Edge, aims to change the way people think about democracy. In this excerpt from our 2006 interview, LaPaix talks about the difference between what she calls thin democracy and real democracy.
I grew up with the notion that democracy was voting and it was a market economy. And if you had both of those things, if you had elected government and you had a market economy, then voila, you have democracy and you're home free. And I think that's the notion, what I call thin democracy, that we're now attempting and failing at exporting to a country like Iraq. And I believe that it fails for this reason. A market economy, as we've defined it, is driven by a single rule. Now, markets can be driven by many rules, but we've settled for this illogical notion that we can create benign outcomes by one rule, highest return to existing wealth, the shareholders, what returns to them. So you have such increasing concentration of wealth that it is held so tightly in the world today, to jump to the world level, 691 billionaires control more wealth than half the world's people make in an entire year. That degree of concentration, and now it's accelerating in our own country among the top 1% and half of 1%, that it inevitably infects the political process. so that now 61 lobbyists representing those narrow interests for the most part walk the halls of Washington's power corridors for every one person that you and I elect to represent us there. So we are outnumbered, we citizens are outnumbered 61 to 1. And I contrast that to what I call living democracy, the notion that democracy is not just a structure of government, it is a way of life that engages all of us. And it means, you know, minimally, it means removing the power of wealth from the political process and infusing the power of citizen voices into the political process.
And you define power in a very particular way.
Well, I think a lot of people are afraid of power. And if you go to the root of power, it comes from the Latin posse, meaning to be able. It's really our capacity to act. And, of course, our capacity to act means our capacity to protect ourselves, our families, our values, everything that we hold dear. We often think of our power as being over and against someone else or being very individual, and yet we realize that actually that often we don't even know what our real self-interest is until we're engaged in dialogue with others. And the power that is ours as we join with others and we learn to negotiate differences, and that's what I call relational power. Just very practically speaking, I mean, what do I want for now? My granddaughter, I'm just a new grandmother, still, just in awe of this moment. So what do I want for Josie? I mean, it's, you know, good schools and safe streets and healthy air to breathe and water to drink. And of course, how do I have that for my own very individual granddaughter? It's only through working with others in my community and in this country and the world to achieve that. We can't achieve our own individual interest unless we are working and listening to others' interests. The key to the satisfaction is making more and more conscious the relationships that are embedded in what we purchase. So one particular way that I focus on that more and more Americans are aware of, the movement of fair trade in particularly coffee, but now extending beyond, that is part of what I'm talking about here in terms of our seeing our purchases as relating us to other real people in the world.
Frances Moore LaPay talking with me about her book, Democracy's Edge. She contributed an essay to Martin Keogh's book, Hope Beneath Our Feet. Her latest book is Getting a Grip. We spoke to her about that one on Writer's Voice in 2007. To hear that full interview, go to writersvoice.net. Finally, we hear from Bill McKibben. Long an environmental journalist and author, he turned several years ago to activism, founding the worldwide climate action movement 350.org. We last talked to him for Earth Day 2010 about his latest book, Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H. He spells it that way to underscore that we don't live on the same planet we were born into.
We really have now changed this planet. It's already a different place than the one we were born on to. It'll be more different still in decades to come, but the kind of damage that change that I was predicting 20 years ago when I wrote The End of Nature is now very real and apparent, and that means that we're going to have to start living on this new planet in new ways, learn some new habits that are appropriate to our new habitat, and hence the title.
I think a lot of people really don't get this. I find almost invariably when I talk about climate change that people are talking in terms of children and grandchildren. And my mother just the other day said, well, that's not something you're going to have to worry about.
Yeah, there's a whole riff in the beginning of the book with sort of, quote, dozens of people, famous people, talking about how climate change is a real threat to grandchildren. Would that it were so. This is happening in very real time. The Global Humanitarian Forum, the first big academic attempt to measure the effects of climate change, is estimating that already about 300,000 people around the world die each year from the effects of global warming. We see the Arctic melting at a violent, rapid rate. We see big changes in hydrology, in precipitation, and in drought. The world is already warming. We've raised the temperature about 1 degree already. Unless we do things very rapidly to change our course. We're going to see the temperature rise another 4 or 5 degrees in the course of this century. This is the question for our time.
And when you say a rise of 4 or 5 degrees in our century, those of us who have been following this closely just shudder right down to our core. But for those who haven't been following it, what kind of a planet are we talking about?
A grim one. One where nothing works anywhere near as easily as we're used to. One of the points I try to make in the book is that we're already seeing big economic effects of those kind of changes. You know, where I live in the northeastern U.S., the number of storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period is up about 20% over the baseline. Those are the kind of storms that do nobody any good, that wash away infrastructure, that wash away crops, that leave insurance companies with huge problems. In a planet where we're already running short of oil, where we're already running short of money, where we're already strapped for enough food for a growing population, having to deal with huge destabilizing changes in the basic physical stability of the planet may well be the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back, at least the camel of endless growth and expansion. We're going to have to call it quits with that and figure out, I think, instead, how to relocalize and scale down our demands on the planet.
Now, when you say where you live, you live in northern Vermont.
Yes, yeah.
And you're already seeing major economic damage from climate change.
Our little town in Vermont, the town where Robert Frost spent his summers, had the summer before last, I sort of begin the book by describing that it, 6 weeks apart, it had the two largest rainstorms in its history in the course of August. And they washed away half the town. You know, our road, we were cut off from the rest of the world for days. The governor had to arrive by helicopter. It took millions of dollars to patch up the one road into town. This is the sort of thing happening all around the world.
You say in your latest book, Earth, that even if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide totally right now, the climate is not going to go back to normal, not even in 100 or 200 years. How do scientists know that?
If we do everything right, I mean, and by that I mean everything, if we really, really worked hard to get ourselves off coal and gas and oil in the next couple of decades, then in about 100 years or so, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would drop back below about 350 parts per million. It's about 390 parts per million now. And scientists tell us that 350 parts per million level, it represents some kind of safety. That's why we've run this huge global campaign the last couple of years called 350.org. But in the years between now and then, there's going to be some irreversible damage done. We don't have a plan for refreezing the ice sheets of the Arctic or refreezing the quickly melting glaciers of Greenland and the Antarctic. We're going to see sea levels go up. We're going to see the ocean. I'm staring out the window. I'm here in California today, and I'm staring out the ocean at the Pacific, a vast, wide Pacific. That water, and indeed all the seawater in the world, is about 30% more acid than it was 50 years ago, because of the carbon we've poured into the atmosphere. The atmosphere itself holds about 5% more water vapor than it did in 1970. That's an unbelievable change in a short period of time, due solely to the fact that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. As we warm the planet, it grows moister. These scale of changes aren't things we can easily turn the clock back on.
You know, we're already suffering from an economic recession, a depression, really, if you talk about unemployment in many places. How are we going to be able to take care of developing nations adapting to climate change and our own?
I think that probably the answer is around the world that we're going to need to do two sort of opposite things. One is to dramatically localize our economies, to make them less vulnerable, more stable. Stop moving food thousands of miles at a clip. Start producing energy on rooftops and with wind turbines close to home. At the same time, for reasons both of practicality and of morality, we're going to need to extend some kind of helping hand, mostly in the form of these renewable technologies, to the poorest countries around the world, so that they have some chance of developing even somewhat dignified lives without burning the coal that they have on hand.
Climate change legislation failed to pass a Congress last year, and the new Congress coming in is filled with climate change deniers. I asked Bill McKibben what hope he saw for real action on the climate in this political landscape.
I think the only thing we can say for certain is that if we can build a real movement, then the odds of something good happening go up. At the moment, you know, the lobbyists are really driving the bills, and that's why they look so weak and pathetic. It's why we need to build a stronger grassroots movement. Our next big chance may come in early fall. At 350.org, we're sponsoring what we call a global work party all over the world on the 10th of October, 10-10-10. There will be thousands and thousands of communities where people are doing things like putting up solar panels or insulating homes, not because we think we can solve climate change one solar panel at a time. We can't. The mathematics make it clear we can only solve it with legislation that changes the price of carbon. But by doing this great global work party all over the world, we want to send one message to our leaders. If we can get to work, you can get to work. If I can get up on the roof of the school with a hammer and put in a solar panel, you can get up on the floor of the Senate and do your damn job, which for 20 years you failed to do as regards climate change. That's the message we want to get across. We need a movement. Hopefully we can spur something much better than the kind of sorry collection of bills currently in front of Congress.
I think I want to ask you, you know, with the dire predictions, before we go on to some of the things that we can do about it, how do you handle this emotionally?
Being as active as I can in trying to do something about it. I think that's why I'm pleased that we're able to do this stuff at 350.org, and it's why I'm really happiest when I'm at home helping build the sort of strong local economies that we're going to need everywhere in order to deal with this sort of new world that's coming.
McKibben sees some reasons for hope. He sees a growing awareness of the need to replace our wasteful, endless, growth-oriented, fossil fuel-based paradigm with something more sustainable.
Instead of big, centralized combustion of fossil fuels, which are BTU-rich and concentrated and found in a few places, we're going to have very diffuse and scattered sources of energy like sun and wind. That makes a lot of sense to try to do close to home. Instead of being able to ship food 5,000 miles at a clip, we're going to need to grow it closer to home. That means that it's good news that farmers' markets are the fastest growing part of the food economy in America. Not only are these things good physically, environmentally, they're also, I think, good psychologically, socially. One of the things that's happened in the last 50 years as we've used ever more fossil fuel is we've become ever more kind of hyper-independent. We took as our great dream building bigger houses farther apart from each other. And one result of that has been that Americans are much less connected. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. That's a great loss. And I think one of the compensations for the trauma that we're going to undergo as we have to try to deal with this new reality is that we're likely to build stronger communities in the process.
Well, that all sounds pretty nice. But when you're talking about cutting a growth paradigm, you're talking about possibly cutting jobs, cutting prosperity. It's kind of what the right has been criticizing climate change legislation for. They're saying we can't afford this in the middle of a recession. Are you playing right into their hands?
Well, I think in the long run, you know, at some certain level, people like Rush Limbaugh understood 20 years ago, that climate change was a very serious threat to their picture of what the world should be. And they're, at some level, correct about that. We can't keep having the world we have at the moment if we're going to be serious about chemistry and physics. There are ways to make that transition happen so that it's not unbelievably painful and ugly, I think. I hope the longer we put off trying to avoid it, the harder those set of choices become. But, you know, we look at things like in my state, we see the spread of this new agriculture. In fact, across the U.S., the number of farms increased over the last agricultural census for the first time in 125 years. That's good news because most of those are smaller, labor-intensive farms started by young people eager to grow food for their neighbors. That provides a lot of jobs over time. You know, we're never going to go back to 50% of America farming, but we've got less than 1% of America farming now. We have more prisoners than farmers in this country. And so as we build local food economies, we'll need people to grow local food, so on and so forth. The same with energy, the same with culture. You know, the only growing part of the music industry right now is local performance and festivals, people consuming music and the company of each other, and people relying on people, their neighbors, in essence, for culture and entertainment. These things strike me as plausible futures. What doesn't strike me as a plausible future is trying to keep doing exactly what we've been doing now that we know it's running us into a wall.
You're really talking about changing the culture in a very big way, and you're also talking about not just local economies, but local action. How effective do you feel is this kind of citizen action in actually changing the culture that can create the political will to change the legislators?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that it's possible now to imagine a kind of new political architecture, and it's sort of suggested by the Internet. When we do these huge globe-spanning political things like 350.org, we're able to organize them over the net, then they happen in the real world, and then, crucially, we take the images of them and get them back up on the web, make them more than the sum of their parts. You know, people can go look at the 25,000 pictures in our Flickr account at 350.org. That sounds ephemeral and soft, but in fact, when we got to Copenhagen, on the basis of the huge momentum from this giant day of action, we were able to convince 117 of the world's nations to back this quite dramatic 350 target. That was amazing, considering that we'd only launched the campaign 18 months before and that we did it without, you know, real money or anything else. The only problem was that it was the wrong 117 nations. It was the poor and vulnerable developing nations, not the rich, powerful, addicted nations. So we've still got lots of work to do, and we're still committed to doing that work and moving ahead with some real vigor.
Bill McKibben. To hear our full interview, go to writersvoice.net. You can also hear our 2007 interview with him about his book, Deep Economy. McKibben contributed an essay to the anthology Hope Beneath Our Feet, edited by today's first guest, Martin Keogh. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.